This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
This is Hawkins. I don't know the worst thing that's ever happened here in the 4 years I've been working here.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematica Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at Stranger Things Season 1, specifically focusing on the Demogorgon. We'll go over a little bit of news first, tell you a little bit about this TV show, our thoughts, and then talk about the Demogorgon, including what we think it's eating, its life history, the concept of bipedalism, and then we'll talk about why nostalgia is such a powerful storytelling device. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments. We will have time codes below, so you can skip ahead to whatever you are looking for today. Before we get stuck in, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. I'm not doing a voice today because I have to imitate a fucking kid, and all these kids have such annoying voices. My God. Oh. Last but not least, we are joined by Dave, finally, once again, a vet and our movie physiologist.
He is a vet again, finally.
We've been hit by COVID this week. Well, not all of us, half of us.
Half the pod down.
Yeah, wear your masks, listeners.
Quadruple vaccinated?
We are.
Quadruple vaccinated, which could only do so much. I mean, I would say it definitely mattered in the sense of probably making our symptoms a lot better than they could have been.
But you're feeling all right now?
Yeah, for sure. Even when you have all the measures in place and you're quadruple vaccinated and you're in, I would say, relatively good shape physically, if no one else is following the rules, it is very, very, very easy to get a very contagious disease, which is exactly what happened to us.
You can tell that Adam's feeling sick because when he said in relatively good shape, he didn't flex like he normally does. So
didn't make his titties bounce.
I'm flexing right now.
It was really delightful having, you know, being quadruple vaccinated, having COVID and watching the Eurovision final and seeing maybe four masks in an entire arena, just signaling that apparently the world has moved on.
And on the subject of Eurovision, you can feed wolves bananas?
Yes, you can.
As we've said before, that sometimes at some points of the year when prey is sparse, wolf diets can get up to like 80% non-meat based. But that doesn't mean you should be feeding them bananas.
But what happens when you feed Finn Wolfhard a banana?
I don't know, probably whine about how he wants something else. Sorry. We'll get into that in my dislikes later today.
It's what Mike would do. I don't know about Finn as a person. And before that wolf eats my grandma, give that wolf a banana,
give that wolf. Movie monster related news. Has anybody seen the new Avatar teaser trailer?
Yes.
No, I have not.
I think you should watch it, just because, I mean, it's Avatar. The story's going to be nothing spectacular. Like, you're not going to get any key spoilers.
The story will probably be the same story as Pocahontas 2.
Is that the one where she goes to London?
It is. She marries the actual person she marries in real life.
Yep.
Okay, so it's all the blue cat people going to London? Space London.
And potentially dying of syphilis.
Okay. Nice. I look
Which
forward
is what
to
I'm
that.
Pretty sure happened over the real Pocahontas.
I hope it's the reverse, where all the avatars now get human avatar bodies and they go to the human world.
Ooh.
Oh, God. They just, like, spend half the movie whinging about how tiny and, like, unfit we are.
How they can't plug their tails into trees and horses.
Yeah. Imagine just being put in a child's body and having to, like, you know, do your daily chores and all that sort of shit. Avatar looks fantastic. There looks like it's going to be, like, a bunch of new creatures that we can talk about. So we will definitely get stuck into that movie later in the year. Yeah.
Are we going to have a Is there going to be the return of fucking what's-his-face?
I thought he got killed.
But I hope he comes back with, like, a cyborg head or something.
Yeah, or maybe they make an avatar using his body. Ooh. Human avatar.
Well, I have one bit of, like, actual real ecology news. Biden, the maybe not the best choice, but the better choice we had for a president in the United States, he has canceled millions of acres of oil and gas lease sales in public waters. So this is one of those things that, like, we shouldn't have to cheer that because that should be a given. You shouldn't be selling public waters because they're public. But it's been canceled, and at least for the moment, that area will be safe going forward.
And look, speaking of politics, to our Australian listeners, we've got an election coming up. We've also got summer coming up at the end of this year, and it's only going to get worse in terms of climate-related extreme heat events. So if you're wondering who you should be voting for, I won't tell you which party to vote for, but just check out people's climate change policies. Check out our party's climate change policies.
Who will you tell them not to vote for?
Scott Morrison. Don't vote
Scott
for
Scott Morrison. I was about to say. Yeah. The coal party.
Do not vote for Scott Morrison. Do not vote for One Nation. Vote for people who take climate change seriously and are going to act in Australia's interest in the future.
Because if the Earth's not here, where else is Greenzo going to dance?
Thanks for getting the message out, Greenzo. You're saving the world.
All right. What happens when a game comes to life and one of the players gets sucked into the game's alternate reality and is trapped there until his friends defeat the final boss, freeing him from time and space? If you're a scrub who plays basic board games, you might be playing Jumanji, but if you have more sophisticated palette, you're probably playing Dungeons & Dragons in a strange little town called Hawkins, Indiana. With the help of a traumatized girl with telekinesis and a badass bad-armed babysitter that's coiffed for the gods, a ragtag friend group of losers fight against evil scientists, dimensional aliens, and most annoyingly, adults that don't believe them, to save their pale-faced pal from peril. And a girl named Barb learns a valuable life lesson in how to choose your friends.
Hashtag justice for Barb.
Hashtag Nancy's a cunt.
Yep.
Worst friend ever.
The start of season two, where she's just like, should I tell these people what happened to their daughter so they don't sell their house? What do we like about season one of Stranger Things?
The first time I watched this, I really loved Winona Ryder's portrayal of a mom. And particularly, there's the one episode where the Demigorgon has ripped through the house when she's trying to find her son. And she's basically been like praying or hoping for anything that she can get that will try and help her find her kid again. And she's run out of the house, she's gotten away from it, and she's standing at the car. But then she realizes that the only link she has back to her kid is potentially in the house. And we get to watch her as she slowly closes the car and this lone woman prepares to, like, go back into the house. That is some fucking badass mom qualities. And I remember just watching that the first time and being like, that is one of the most realistic of, like, she is terrified. It's not one of those, like, oh, I'm so mom-like, I'm not even scared. Like, no, she is terrified, but she's going to go back in there to try and find Will. And I was like, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, bouncing off that, two things. I love Winona Ryder, and I'm really glad she got, like, the resurgence of popularity with Modern Crowds through this show. Yeah. Because I just have always found her a phenomenal actor, and it was really nice to see her in this. I think for me with this show, it is very reminiscent of movies like Now and Then or Goonies or Sandlot, where if you had a group of close-knit friends growing up, it's such a strong nostalgic identifier. And if you didn't, then it's still like this bittersweet vicarious living through like the friend group you never had. But either way, it's a great way to like get you right in the feels of just having that, you know, squad of pals to have your back in all these crazy situations or adventures that you go on together.
I really like that there's just so many characters who you expect to just be dicks, and they're not. There's so many people in this who are just nice, you know? Like, you've got you could have the creepy science teacher type, but he's not. He's just a really nice guy. Season two, yeah. More so, you've got this government scientist who you think is going to be a dick, but he's not. He's a really nice guy. To top it all off, you have Steve fucking Harrington, the best hair in show business. And you know what? When I watched this for the first time, there's a bit where he, like, destroys will Jonathan buy his camera, right? Yeah. And at the time when I watched it, I thought they were building up to Steve Harrington being a dick. So I was like, oh yeah, fuck this guy. But looking back on it, watching, knowing that Steve Harrington is going to be a good guy, I'm like, yeah, I mean, he took pictures of your girlfriend undressing. Fucking break his camera.
Yeah.
One last thing. It's just, there is a scene where Eleven has just saved Mike, brought him back from jumping over the cliff edge. And Dustin screaming out, yeah, that's right, you better run. She's our friend and she's crazy. You come back here and she'll kill you. Had me in tears. Absolute tears. Yeah. And lastly, because I just have to throw this in there, I love how little compunction Eleven has and is given about just murdering people en masse. Like, I really thought at some point there was going to be like a, no, Eleven, you can't kill people, but nah, like season one, season two, she's just murdering constantly.
Yeah, this show's fantastic. I think that it's one of those things where Libby mentioned having that like group of friends growing up and that nostalgia bringing you back to it. And even if you didn't have it, it's giving you that feeling of what you missed out on. And while I didn't grow up in a town that was quite as small as Hawkins, it was a university town, so decent sized, but this still, even though I didn't grow up in the 80s, I grew up in the 90s, this really puts me back to my childhood in so many different ways of having those friends, going to their house for the weekend, going on adventures in the woods, which is literally just going into the woods and like poking each other with sticks. But that was like a fucking adventure when you were a kid. And that's what this show like really captured. And add on top of that, some really quality acting, incredible production design and value. The monster's interesting. The mystery aspect of it is cool. The like small town in the south and in the fall rather in like, you know, rural US, love it. Definitely Dustin yelling our friend and she's crazy is one of my highlights of the season.
Yeah, whoever cast the show is like 9 out of 10. They did a fantastic job.
Yeah, building off of that, this show is definitely, especially season one, is for me the like the pinnacle of what child acting should be. Not just, they weren't annoying, it was, oh, they weren't annoying, and they were really good actors. So, credit to all of them, where it's due.
Yeah, so, building off what Adam said for what we didn't like about this. So, Finn Wolfhard and Noah Schnapp, look, they're completely fine. I don't think it's their fault at all. But right from the very start to this point, I have never found Will Byers and Mike anything but excruciatingly annoying. I kind of... Don't get me wrong, I love the other two, and I think Eleven and Max, when they join that group, are great, but Will and Mike, my God, out the window with them every season. I never wanted Will to be found because he was so fucking whiny for it from the start. Nah, not having him. But like I said, not the actor's fault at all. They're kids, and like Adam said, for a show with this many child actors to not have any that like really piss you off as actors is phenomenal.
100%.
I think I thought that Hopper in the very first season was just kind of a grumpy dick and he was going to grow and develop. And then as it went on, I realized that he was literally just a grumpy dick. Yeah, David Harbour has not aged well as an actor in terms of his stint as Hellboy and hearing about all the shit he pulled behind scenes of fucking with the set, ignoring the director and just going off and being like, I'm going to write it myself because I know better. I have a lot of trouble rewatching this and looking at Hopper as anything other than just like, eh.
I never understood the Hopper love. He was just always a fucking sourpuss to me.
I love him.
Me too, yeah.
My didn't like is Nancy and Jonathan. These characters are frustrating, filler, and fodder. Please get them out. I could give a fuck less about their dumb love story. I could give a fuck less about them as characters. They're like a hindrance to the story. They're not villains, but yet I find myself hating them like they are. And so I just don't really understand their place in the show. And I think that kind of becomes really apparent in the second season because they don't really have material for them to like do anything. Whereas you see other characters grow and there's like storylines that open up. Theirs is just kind of like a big wet fart.
It opens up room for more Steve Harrington.
Exactly.
They highlight the fucking cream of the crop. Chef's kiss, Steve Harrington. What a man. Building off of what Libby said, I think that it was one of those things that didn't really click for me until Libby said that just now. And she and I have been going through and watching Twin Peaks recently. And I think that for those of you, the younger listeners who might not be familiar with Twin Peaks, that was a show that was released in the early 90s that Stranger Things takes a lot of influence and inspiration from. But much like Stranger Things, there was a younger couple that was a big focus of the earlier episodes in Twin Peaks, James and Donna. And just like James and Donna, we have Nancy and Jonathan, who are not interesting, they're not charismatic, and there's just way too much of them in the episodes. Get back to the other interesting characters, please. So I don't think it's necessarily the actor's fault. They're just not super captivating to me. But I think my biggest dislike of this is similar to what happened, at least in my experience, with the Harry Potter movies, where the fandom around this show got so insane and annoying, it kind of made me not like it as much anymore and forget how much I actually enjoy this as a show and as a series going forward.
I find that with Rick and Morty big time.
Ooh, I could see that.
Yeah, right? It's fun watching a cartoon show, but a guy screaming Pickle Rick dressed in a costume, and you're like...
Just going off what you were saying about Nancy and Jonathan, they even bring in a better Nancy and Jonathan in season 3. Like when they bring in Steve and pair him with Robin Buckley. Those two are way more charismatic. Yeah. And
oh my God, they're so fun together.
Absolutely.
I know we're all on board the Steve Harrington hype train, and well, we should be. And we'll be talking more about it next week. But I've got to say, just the fucking reveal of those two and their friendship and what it means to them, and like, and how it's not going to be weird because there isn't a romance, was such a breath of fresh air watching that and just seeing like, yeah, Steve, you are the hero we need. Thank you for being a good person.
While we're on the subject of Steve, in the pilot script, Steve Harrington was written as, quote, the biggest douchebag on the planet, going so far as to do some horrendous things to Nancy Wheeler's character. But the character changed when actor Joe Keery turned out to be, and this is a quote, much more likable and charming than the Duffer brothers, Matt and Ross Duffer, originally had envisioned. So they literally changed the role based off of Joe Keery's charming personality.
Thank God.
That's nice. Fantastic.
So just a very short bit of trivia here. It's nothing specific, but when this is set, was right around the time that that Dungeons & Dragons was getting a lot of negative backlash, and there was controversy surrounding it because it allegedly promoted Satanism in the 1980s. Oh. You can look at, there's a lot of, you know, articles about this sort of stuff from back in the day, but essentially there was like one woman who, I think something awful happened to her son. Yeah, I think her son committed suicide. And she essentially blamed, Dungeons and Dragons, and was an advocate against its existence for the rest of her life until she died in 1997, basically.
So, yeah, it's one of those unfortunate things with the late 70s, early 80s, like the satanic panic that happened with Dungeons and Dragons being wrongly blamed because, oh my God, harmless nerds in a basement having fun with each other. They're obviously using doing math. Something terrible. Yeah, it's very sad what happened to her, to that woman's son as well.
Yeah, and if you want to look up into slightly more serious and way more awful shit that was happening, there's a lot of Reds Under the Bed McCarthyism stuff kind of alluded to and very much focused on in season 3. Yep. Look up McCarthyism and look at what happened to some prominent, very prominent American, and not just American, North American, it happened in Australia as well, figures in the 60s and 70s. The whole thing was fucked.
It really was.
Yeah, and look, we've talked about Barbara Kingsolver books on here before. If you ever want to read something that focuses on that in a bit of detail, The Lacuna is a fantastic look at the effects of McCarthyism on one man in particular. So, yeah,
cool.
Highly recommend giving it a go.
My bit of trivium. So, there are twin toddlers who portrayed Holly Wheeler, and then they also, I think, played the same actor who played Millie's younger sister, Ava. They were initially very frightened by the Demogorgon suit, the practical one, not the CGI creation, obviously. But to help calm them down, a crew member told them that the Demogorgon was actually a benevolent monster from the Monsters, Inc. film, or series of films.
Aww.
So I like to imagine, you know, you've got Mike Wazowski and then the fucking Demogorgon coming out of a closet to eat a child.
Capturing your laughs.
Yeah.
I really like this bit of trivia. This was an interview on NPR with the Duffer brothers, and they were praising Millie Bobby Brown for being just like this really gifted child actor, saying that she was able to adjust her performance to different lens or camera positions in a way that most child actors don't even know how to do yet. But they also said that there were times on set where she reminded them that she was just a little girl. And the example that they gave was, and this is a quote, "One day she showed up on set and she was just covered head to toe in glitter. And she's like, I don't know where all this glitter came from. And it's like, I'm not having this problem with any of my adult actors. David Harbour is not coming to set covered in glitter." And then they said that the removing the glitter all over took a 45 minute delay in shooting that day.
Oh my God.
Wow.
We have to bring this up again. The fact that Millie Bobby Brown is somehow British and yet at the same time has the most like deep South, like redneck backwater name I've ever heard in my goddamn life.
Yes.
Millie Bobby!
Millie Bobby Brown!
God damn it, Millie Bobby Brown, you get back in this house right now.
Fantastic American accent, too.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah. Welcome back now. Here.
Before we start looking at the Demogorgon in more detail, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hasik Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also find us on Discord. You can find the link to our server in the episode description or on the website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and find a writhing, tentacled mass of short stories. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore, less movie-related science that Adam and I write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you're enjoying the podcast, tell a friend about it. Leave us an in-app rating, preferably, as always, of the five-star variety. And tell us about what movies or TV shows or even games you'd like to see us cover on the podcast. We're always looking for fan suggestions.
So as we know from season one, the Demogorgon is a gangly nightmare of a creature. It's one of those things where, looking back on it now, having seen so much of it and it becoming a part of popular culture in a different way than its actual inspiration, which, look it up, the Demogorgon from Dungeons & Dragons is vastly different than the creature we get in the show. But it's become so common that I don't really think about it as scary anymore. But going back with season one and kind of seeing it for the first time with these characters again, it's like, oh yeah, this like big gangly fuck that has a flower for a head that screams at you and can come through your fucking wall and take you to another dimension is horrifying.
Yeah,
it's
that shot where they're developing like the negative and they see it in the corner of the photo. That was
I
mean, her first interaction when she comes across it, Millie Bobby Brown in the darkness and stumbles on the thing and it's eating something. And then she interrupts it and it turns and screams.
Why did she poke it? Leave it alone. Cut a wide berth around the motherfucker. My God.
Yeah.
She'd been ordered to go back in.
It's kind of, it seems to be an ambush predator, but I don't know if that's its normal method of hunting or if that's just because the show's, you know, going for dramatic effect.
It's... So the writers of the show liken it more to the shark from Jaws than to It, or from Pennywise from the It franchise, Pennywise being the interdimensional space monster. Because like Pennywise, the Demogorgon is able to go from one dimension to another, and that's how it comes to Earth in the first place. Millie Bobby Brown, Eleven, attracts its attention when it's trying to have its little egg snack, and then it finds out, ooh, look, Earth, there's all these tasty people I can go over and eat. And much like a shark coming out of the water to take a victim, and the Demogorgon comes from its dimension, snatches somebody, like a poor helpless person like Barb, brings them back to its dimension, and then feeds on them at its leisure. So this creature is about 2 meters tall, maybe a bit more, depending on which part of the show you're looking at or which specific Demogorgon itself. But 2 to 3 meters tall, thin, bipedal for the most part. Very slimy, slick-looking skin, much like an amphibian. And it has this weird flower bud head that opens like a starfish. More of a radial symmetry than a bilateral symmetry. A very interesting thing in a monster. And definitely tugging on those heartstrings of discomfort and strangeness.
Yeah. So we've all got some different theories on what this thing could be feeding on. Who wants to go first?
If it's an amphibian, it is more than likely going to be feeding on something aquatic, even though we never see it in water. So this is hard to say. We never really get a true glimpse of what its actual home looks like. So the structure of its mouth makes you think something slippery and small, like a jellyfish, because...
Some slippy shit.
Like a slippy shit. Something slippy, something shitty, like a slippy shit that it would need to be able to grab a hold of and keep in its mouth, much like a sea turtle eating a jellyfish.
What this reminded me of was a lamprey's mouth. So lampreys have kind of these radial mouths with teeth that kind of help them stick onto their prey. And then they have tongues, which are called siphons. And depending on the mode of feeding that the lamprey depends on, so whether that's tearing chunks of flesh out and consuming them or sucking blood, they have specialized tongues to help them do either of those things. So they will latch on to, say, a fish. Often, if it's sea lamprey, they'll latch on to salmonids or cod or larger fish like that. And they'll either gouge out flesh or they'll stick their siphon in looking for blood vessels and then start consuming the blood of the species they've chosen. They're fascinating creatures because they're another one of these species that has essentially gone pretty much unchanged. They have had, you know, evolutionary differences, of course, but for the last 360 million years, they've looked almost exactly the same, which is incredible.
Anagenesis, I believe is the term for that.
Yeah, and they're a huge problem in some parts of the world now.
The Great Lakes.
The Great Lakes in the US and Canada. They got in there in the 50s and along with overfishing caused the demise of, almost caused the demise of the lake trout population there. They have treated the Great Lakes extensively with lampricide to kill off the lampreys, but they're still a problem. And they're not going away anytime soon. But thankfully, those fisheries have recovered and a lot of people's jobs have come back. Not to mention there's been, you know, an enormous restoration of some of the biodiversity there. But yeah, I kind of pictured the Demogorgon as this creature who, for some reason, bipedal, we'll get into that later, but can latch itself onto larger prey and tear chunks out of it whilst holding onto it with these kind of, with this pentaradial structure that it's got going on, where it uses those things to just latch on to a larger bit of prey and just tear chunks out bit by bit. It's not what we see it doing in the show, though.
Kind of. This feeding strategy makes sense because one of the issues that Sam has had with the Demogorgon is, despite it being bipedal and having hands that can operate things, you don't really see it manipulating food like a primate would, or like humans are primates, but if you see a chimpanzee eating or a gorilla, they're using their hands and bringing food to their mouth. They're not bent over on all fours consuming whatever they're eating. And if the Demogorgon is feeding by latching onto something with this horrible nightmare mouth, it would make sense if it's a bigger creature and maybe they hunt in packs like we see with the younger form of them. We'll talk more about next week. But if it's holding on with its big hands and gripping a larger animal so then its face can get in there and latch on and eat, that makes a lot more sense compared to how we see it consuming the deer in season one.
Yeah. And I don't think it would be potentially hunting in packs because I don't think it would want to take down its prey. I think it would want to jump on, take out a couple of chunks, and then just let it swim on, as a lot of lampreys do.
Maybe. I don't know if that would work for an organism this large.
Yeah, well, this comes down to, do they have massive kind of megafauna in the Upside Down somewhere?
The only thing we see it eating from the Upside Down is whatever that egg is. And it looks like it's having a hell of a time getting into that thing, which could suggest that some of its feeding, because I still like the idea that you guys have proposed, but it may, like the starfish, be going after things that are basically equivalent to mollusks, where it's using its face appendages to open it up so it can get inside and basically scoop those out, and using its front limbs to sort of hold itself in place while it does that.
Yeah, but again, I really feel like the front limbs are going to be better at that sort of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make a suggestion about its prey. I'm going to suggest that the deer that we ran into had been betrayed by a close friend and placed in an awkward situation before it had been ostracized prior to it being eaten. I'm going to suggest that the egg was also in that situation, and that would also fill in with the consumption of barb, that these are the criteria that has to be met. That the creature basically has to wait until someone is at its lowest emotional point And that's when it steps in. Like, that deer was just feeling, like, really heartbroken, leaned against a tree somewhere, and it was like, God, I thought Kyle had my back there. And that is when the Demogorgon decided to make its move.
Yeah, because the Demogorgon specializes on third wheels.
But in terms of our hunting prey and tracking it, Dave, you had some thoughts on the creature without a face?
Yeah, I mean, we don't see any eyes that are basically attached to this creature all the way through. And so I went digging to try and see, because we've talked a lot about different creatures that consume material without using eyes. And we've spent lots of time talking about sound. There's been a bunch of people that have talked about the Demogorgon and been like, oh, well, you know, it makes that screeching noise. Maybe it's hunting like a bat. I actually think that this guy is probably taking on more of a smell-based sensation, which seems to be what the creators have suggested as well. They've made the suggestion that it's like a shark, hence when Barb has that little bit of drop in the water, that's how it finds it. Since it doesn't live in an aquatic environment, I don't think that it's tracking smell through the water. But being really good at tracking your prey via smell and being able to track them over huge distances, or in this case, between dimensions, yeah. And the one that I wanted to bring up was mosquitoes. Because I get into this argument on a frequent basis with people where people will bring up one factor and they'll be like, oh, well, mosquitoes track you based on your blood group, or mosquitoes track you based on your sweat, or mosquitoes track you based on your... The wonderful thing about, or terrible thing about mosquitoes, is that everyone is right. So we know that mosquitoes use a variety of different clues to track down humans. They are able to track using body heat. They also take in carbon dioxide. It's actually one of the first signals that they use to basically track, and that they can find you with your carbon dioxide sensors approximately 30 feet away.
God damn it. Just by breathing.
I just want to issue a statement on behalf of mosquitoes everywhere. There's only a very small percentage of mosquitoes that go after human blood, and even then it's only the females. So just, you know, that's your daily announcement from Big Mosquito.
So Sam wants to talk about blood-sucking women, apparently, and make the focus on blood-sucking women. So on that note, the mosquitoes that do track you, I was reading through a really interesting paper where they were looking at the fact that apparently there are some sensors that are present with the olfactory sensation where mosquitoes go after you finding lactic acid. So basically in your sweat, and they found that you can take mosquitoes and genetically alter them to remove certain genes that help them with their olfactory sensation. However, the researcher at the end, which made me very happy, said, yeah, we slightly reduced them to find you in this one capability, but then they just fell back on any of their other mechanisms to track your ass down. And he went, to everybody out there who's hoping that, like, oh, well, I just need to, like, cover myself in wolf piss and I'll hide myself from their smell. And he was like, look, guys, the thing is they have all these redundant mechanisms for tracking you. You can knock out their olfactory. You can knock out their carbon dioxide. You can knock out their heat sensation. You're not going to knock them all out. And the mosquitoes are still going to track you down and find you.
Even mosquito nets. I was in Tanzania and fell asleep in my bed, which was surrounded by a mosquito net. And in the middle of the night, my arm leaned up against a mosquito net. And in the morning, I just had a circular patch of about 20,000 mosquito bites in one small area where it was touching the mosquito net.
A mosquito has chosen me as her perch. Another one. And another one. Why, it's a whole flock. They like me. They're nuzzling my flesh with their noses. Now they're...
Ah! I mean, I don't have any concerns with this creature probably tracking its human, deer, egg-based prey, secondary to smell, but there's probably also other mechanisms. We see that it exists in quite a cold landscape, so having thermal sensitivity makes sense as well. And the world does appear to be quite dark and poorly lit, which would make the use of eyes, potentially redundant.
And they're very expensive to make.
So as much as we love to focus on, oh, well, they'll find you using this one mechanism, generally speaking, nature builds backups. Humans have a terrible sense of smell, but we can still use it to find things.
Yeah, farts.
Sam, if you're tracking your prey based on farts, I have questions.
You'll have no problem finding me.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. It'll lead you straight to Adam.
Let's come back to bipedalism then, because it is odd, this creature, right? Because, I mean, there are so many advantages to being bipedal, and one of them is that it frees up your hands. Now, we'll go into a bit more on later on why that's not perhaps the selection pressure that initially gave us bipedalism, but that is one of the big advantages. But you know, you almost never, you maybe see it like holding down people a couple of times with its hands,
yeah.
But it's not manipulating its food, it's not using tools, it doesn't seem to be leaning against anything or using them for balance in any situations. I don't think we even see it climbing. We see it pushing through the kind of
the membrane between the worlds.
Yeah.
Does it use them as, like, kind of intimidation in some scenes? I can't remember. Like, does it raise them to look bigger?
More just kind of does that Freddy Krueger walk towards you, like from the first Nightmare on Elm Street?
Its thriller routine is fantastic.
Yeah. Adam, you said it kind of makes sense for this to evolve in some way?
I mean, if the way that it's feeding is in a lamprey-style attachment and bite-slash-suck whatever you can out of its prey...
Yeah.
If that prey is a larger, you know, herbivore, omnivore, whatever, and it's bigger than the Demogorgon, which it might be, it would be advantageous to be able to try to hold that prey down with your forelimbs. Oh, yeah. And we see other organisms do this. Lions and other big cats will hold a prey item down with their front limbs, their forelimbs, and then, you know, rip big chunks out, which... If you don't have opposable digits, opposable thumbs rather, and an arm and a shoulder joint like primates do, that's about the best you're going to be able to do. But this creature has a primate shoulder joint and the, you know, fitting an arboreal lifestyle. So
yeah.
It's hard to get around where this exactly came from beyond holding something bigger than it down or a similar size, I should say, to the point where you can't just pick it up and manipulate it. You just have to hold it and try to feed off of it, most likely while it's still alive.
I was going to say, we see that same thing in the nature documentary Blade 2. The vampires with the expandable faces holding things down so they can try and tear pieces out of them.
You see the Xenomorph Queen doing Aliens as well, holding Ripley in her big mech suit and having the little proboscis come out.
Another weird thing about the bipedalism here is that they don't, like, we see their juvenile forms, which are not bipedal. They're quadrupedal, like a dog.
Well, they're slugs, and then they're tadpoles, and then they're quadrupeds.
Yeah, they go through, like, four different phyla on their way to becoming, you know, the Demogorgon.
Yeah.
It's very odd.
Yeah.
But, I mean, changes from one life stage to another are possible.
Yeah, I mean, we see this on a regular basis. Top example we think about when it comes to changes associated with locomotion and leg development are frogs. Tadpoles, the early form of frogs. I mean, they start their life as these organisms that live completely underwater with these tiny little forelimbs and these long tails. But after a few weeks of their development, a hormone actually in their thyroid gland initiates metamorphosis. Now, do you guys know approximately how long it takes for a tadpole to become a frog?
I'm going to guess over about a 24-hour period because that's what it says in your notes.
That's nuts. That's nuts that over a 24-hour period, tadpoles become frogs. That's crazy. Fuck you, butterflies. All right.
Yeah.
Tadpoles to frog have clearly got this shit down.
Yeah.
How bad do you think their growing pains are?
Pretty bad. And
I will give amphibians the speed record, but you gotta give it to butterflies. Fucking caterpillars turn into a pile of goo, and that goo then becomes a butterfly. What the fuck is happening?
And, like, somehow across that transformation, they retain, like, sort of nerve memory. If you get a caterpillar to associate pain with something, it will retain that reflex after it's turned into a butterfly. Fucking fascinating.
The development basically of making a transition where we can see them develop the new attachments for the spinal cord or for orientations or muscle groups that are going to allow them to move from the demi-dog into the demigorgon. I mean, so we've already established nature can do that. We can see big evolutionary loops because it's not just legs that have to develop with frogs. They also have to develop a whole system of organs that allows them to survive outside of the water. Now, what I thought was going to be more complicated is the neural networks, right? You have to learn to walk. We were making fun of the Avatar movie, obviously, at the beginning of this podcast. That is one of the objectively most fun parts of that, is where you get to see him in the giant human body stumbling around trying to learn how to walk again. Now, this got me into a cool loop of reading up on human locomotion. So apparently, for the longest time, the belief has been that when humans make a transition from quadruped, when we're learning to crawl, to bipedalism, it's a completely different system. We're basically learning new neural networks and new setups to allow us to make that transition. And that turns out to be completely false, according to all the new research. Infants actually build on the existing forms of locomotion and basically learn how to change them and alter them and alter those neural pathways to allow them to accomplish bipedalism. And what's really cool is that this is actually conserved. They've looked at other species, and these same types of neural networks that are associated in humans are also found in rats, cats, monkeys, and guinea fowl. In terms of these, this same network to basically learn how to walk looks to be what Adam loves to talk about. The idea that evolution is not some big plan. It's not some wonderfully made organism. It's you stuff parts together using what you've got on hand until you get something that works. And that's basically, we all learn to walk and we're like, eh, this isn't broke. Let's just modify it and fix it and shift it as we develop and grow. My last sort of offside, because as I said, I don't actually have any concerns with the demi-dog becoming the demi-gorgon in terms of just learning different locomotion styles that hit at a certain stage of development.
Yeah.
I got myself during this walking discussion into a common debate that I've wondered myself, which is, in the veterinary field, I see horses that get born and they stand up and they're already fucking walking. And then talking to friends that have given birth to little humans that basically sit as these little things that just eat for a year up until you're like, oh, they finally start walking. That's fantastic. Two? Libby's saying 2 years they learned? Oh, dear God. So.
Maybe three.
Apparently.
Oh, yeah, this you got some fun times coming up, Dave.
So apparently this has been a common debate in neuroscience as to why is it that humans show up so fucking useless right out of the gate. And it turns out that looking across different species, development of the ability to walk seems to be more associated with brain development than it is with actual age. And so horses basically come out, and as anyone who's ever worked with horses before, that's it. All right, they're squarely at one of their like top stages of brain development. They're not going to get that much further. All right, something fight or flight is literally all they do. And one of the reasons it seems to be so delayed associated with humans is just because we have so much further to go in our states of brain development, which is why humans, will not walk under a year of age. Elephant shrews can walk at a year or a day old.
It has a lot to do with the evolution of parental care and caregiving, the ability of a parental organism to give affection, not just affection, but actual nutrition, comfort, safety, even having like a group setting, like a lot of primates do, where uncles and aunts will help take care of the offspring. That then selects and gives the ability for this extended out of the womb development to occur, so the organism can continue to grow and be
cool.
A much more fit organism as an adult, instead of just a prey species that comes out ready to go because it could be killed any second.
Because people might not know this, but we human babies come out and are really useless early on because our brains are still developing, but they can't stay in there any longer. Like if our brains got any bigger and kept developing, it would just kill whoever it's coming out of. Yep. So that's why they talk about the fourth trimester, because it's when, you know, the baby's brain is still developing, but outside of the womb, because if it stayed in the womb, then it's never coming out.
Any of you know what age the human brain stops developing?
Yes.
25.
That would explain a lot.
So Adam's got a couple of years to go.
I'm young and beautiful.
I can handle things. I'm smart. Not like everybody says. Like dumb. I'm smart and I want respect.
When it comes to the actual evolution of bipedalism, we've talked a lot about why it's advantageous. But the reasons that we've talked about it being advantageous, they might not have anything to do with the reason it evolved in the first place. For a long time, scientists thought it was to do with the ability to see further. But seeing as the first organisms in our kind of clade or tribe were likely based in woodlands and in forests, that doesn't really work out. So that theory's been kind of thrown out at this point. But there are still a couple of theories going around. The big problem with this, though, is that it's really hard to test these theories.
Yup.
When we look at fossil records of members of our, I'm going to say tribe here again, or sub-tribe, the Australopithecines or the Hominina.
We should say that Sam is using tribe in the evolutionary history or the biological grouping, meaning of the word.
Yeah, not in the anthropological sense. I mean like a clade or a grouping. The ability to be bipedal seems to stem back about 7 million years is the earliest ancestor that we've found that can do this.
So a pretty new thing.
Yeah, it's a very new thing, and it actually evolved well before the larger brains came along. So Australopithecus and Gracopithecus, two genera of Australopithecines, they could walk upright, but they had pretty small brains. So we often used to think of big brains as being our defining characteristic, but walking upright really is, I would say, arguably more so a characteristic of the clade that we belong to. But yeah, like I said, this seems to date back about 7 million years, and the discovery of some really key species like the Tong child and Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, were big pieces of evidence in this kind of, or big pieces of this puzzle. The strongest indicator of whether these species were bipedal or not is the placement of the, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong in the pronunciation here, the foramen magnum.
Foramen magnum.
The placement of the foramen magnum, which is basically the hole in the skull where the spine goes in. The further away from the back of the skull that hole is, the more likely the species is to be bipedal. It's not a guarantee, but it's a pretty strong indicator. So we've found species going back about 7 million years that have that foramen magnum right underneath the skull, or at least very much further away from the back of the skull. What we do when testing theories about bipedalism is often we look at chimpanzees, but there are problems with that. They do give pretty strong indications, but because chimpanzees are kind of more knuckle walkers, and they don't think that the earliest hominids were evolved from knuckle walkers, but rather more tree-based primates, there's a lot of claims that that's not really a good comparison. But even so, there's a couple of theories as to what drove us to become bipedal. So Charles Darwin actually had a really early theory.
You should marry your cousin.
Marry your cousin, kill foxes that come up to you out of kindness.
Put a beetle in your mouth.
Yes. And then the third was he thought it was so that we could free up our hands. But tool use didn't really show up in large amounts until about 2.5 million years ago. However, that theory was cast aside for a long time because of this lack of evidence of tool use when bipedalism first evolved. But it could have also allowed us to carry food back. So we were talking about family groups before, and the evolution of family groups and monogamy, in a sense, may have prompted us to become bipedal, because you can then carry food back to an area rather than just consuming it on the spot. So you have this kind of give and take whereby usually a female stays and takes care of the infants, and the males go off and then they're able to bring food back because they can walk bipedally. And they have noted that chimps often do this. When they're bringing valuable food back to other members of their group, they will walk bipedally at times. Another theory was that it had to do with energy use. So as the climate changed and we started to walk from patches of grassland, from patches of woodland to others and spread out, we needed to be able to be more energy efficient. And walking upright is more energy efficient.
It is.
Again, tested on chimps. We know that walking upright, especially when it comes to oxygen use, is far more efficient than walking on all fours. This is one of those things where it's really hard for us to know what the correct answer is, and it's really, really tough to solve because we can't test these things properly. The only organism we have as a testing mechanism is a very imperfect one. Unless we get our hands on a TARDIS, there's going to be a lot of theorizing, but nothing concrete.
I told you, Sam, I've been working on it.
Yeah. Just final notes, because I saw this and I was like, that looks like a bad idea. In the finale of season one, they find Will, finally, and there's something stuck down his throat, of course, and Hopper just fucking rips it out immediately. Now, that looks like a bad idea. Dave, you extubate animals all the time. That's a bad idea, right?
It's a bad idea because we usually inflate the tubes, so yes.
Uh-huh.
But generally speaking, biological material down the throat, yeah. It's not a great idea to cut it out with knowing out if it's hooked or connected or attached to anything. Our lungs and trachea don't tend to be super duper durable tissues.
Very flimsy tissue. Also the tissue of the whatever organism it is itself. If you ever have seen people try to take a worm out of a dog or a human even, it is a very delicate, very long, laborious process because you have to slowly extricate this organism because if you're too quick, it'll break off and you'll never find it again. It'll just be in your body somewhere.
Yeah.
Also, they have mechanisms to stay latched inside of the organism. If you've ever tried to take a, I don't know if Dave has in his work, try to take a botfly larva out of a poor small mammal, those things are hooked in and they don't want to come out.
Even just something as simple as ticks. Like, that's why you really have to twist them if you're getting them out of your dog or cat or yourself. The head will just break off and stay in there.
If anyone's wondering how fragile the trachea is, then just be like a normal person and choke on a Dorito the wrong way. Everyone's felt that pain.
I thought you were going to suggest something more in Sam's wheelhouse again and be like, punch Scott Morrison in the throat. But okay, yeah.
I have a question, a science question. This thing really, obviously we've talked about the animalistic side of the Demogorgon, but what about the plant-esque side? To me, this thing always looked like a sundew, if you know what that carnivorous plant is. Is there any sort of reality or universe in which this could have been a plant derivative?
I mean, the creators themselves said they think about it more as a fungus type organism, which is closer to animals than it is to plants, but a non-animal moving around this much, that is a wild evolutionary history that we have seen nothing like on our planet, so I'm not sure.
It would explain why it doesn't know how to use its hands, though. What are these?
They're not actual hands. They're just branches that have come off the side. They're spores. Exactly. They're fungal fruiting bodies, yeah.
There's soon to be new Demogorgons because it's budding.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to do with my hands.
Be good just to hold them down by your side. Yeah, great.
Well, we're real happy.
So, for the story section, what is so powerful that it can influence election results, have advertising agencies spending millions of dollars, globally impact people's taste in food, music, or all of their physical senses, and can cause smile or tears at the drop of a hat? It is nostalgia. It's a word that we use and hear very often, but I don't think we associate with just how powerful it can be. But I kind of wanted to talk about the origin, a little bit of the history of nostalgia. Are any of you familiar with it?
No, I feel like this is one of those things much like a character having dialogue. It's just like, yeah, that's a thing that happens in stories, but was it invented?
Yeah.
Sort of. I mean, it was more one of those things like gravity, like it was just coined. Originally thought to have been coined in 1688 by a Swiss doctor, Johannes Hofer. He came up with the term to identify the homesickness of Swiss soldiers who were reacting physically to hearing certain folk melodies and the eating of rustic soups while away on missions from home.
It says a lot about the quality of life when the nicest thing they had was rustic soups.
Yeah, I think the folk melody too, I can't remember the thing exactly, but I think it's some sort of like cow herding song. So it's like very Swiss.
So Ukraine's submission to Eurovision, basically.
So in fact, the word itself is formed from two Greek roots, nostos, meaning return home or homecoming, and algia, which means pain. And it was considered a psychopathological disorder for about two centuries, from 17th century to 19th century, and sometimes even referred to as a virus. Its original treatment plan was a purposeful incitement of pain and terror, with one Russian general in history threatening to bury any member of his troops alive if they contracted the nostalgic virus, and he even made good on his threats a couple of times.
Sounds Russian.
So, yeah, and they have documents of a young man who missed his like wet nurse and was like nostalgic for that person in his life, and they basically slowly trained him to like not want to be around her. So it was kind of treated like most mental, you know, quote-unquote disorders of the time, horribly.
That sounds less like a nostalgia and more like a developmental disorder to me.
Yeah.
When nostalgia finally made its way to the U.S. after the Civil War, the scare it out of them tactic was replaced with shame it out of them.
No.
More military-related stories. So an American military doctor, Theodore Calhoun, thought nostalgia was something to be ashamed of. So those that suffered from it were, quote, unmanly, idle, and weak-willed, and he proposed curing it with a healthy dose of public ridicule and bullying.
Wow.
Amazing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Take two of these public ridicules and call me in the morning. Jesus.
I never thought I'd ever utter this sentence, but the U.S. healthcare system's come a long way.
Or has.
I love when being idle was a bad thing. Like, oh yes. No, he's idle. Quick, get him back in the field. Make him work more.
Same with unmanly. Heaven forbid you not be manly. Yeah, right?
Gross.
So, over the years, other quality cures included leeches, purging the stomach, and warm hypnotic emulsions. And we'll let you decide on the scale of 1 to 10 how fun that sounds.
Sounds like an enema.
Emulsions.
It absolutely sounds like you're ejaculating someone to me. Yeah. Warm hypnotic emulsions, you're getting stroked.
For medicine. So, yeah, I swear, the doctor said I needed this.
While we know nostalgia that can be complex, it is relatively harmless, we now know. It can be a source of happiness or sadness, but it's the imprint of our first memories as we grew from children into adults. So why do we love it so much as an audience? My theory is that nostalgia is as close to a time machine as we have. You mentioned TARDIS earlier, so this fits in nicely. Things, places, people that exist in our core memories may no longer be around. And even if they are, they can never really be recreated in that order or with that feeling or in that time. So those moments are gone forever. But we can relive wisps or shadows of them with, like, the smell of a magnolia or the taste of banana bread or hearing that particular Beach Boys song come on, you know, the radio. It's the closest thing that we can experience. We can come to experiencing something that is lost. So I think that, for me, Stranger Things wields this weapon well. Obviously, for people who grew up in this time period, it has some really strong connecting references. Like a lot of them. It was kind of overwhelming how many references this show has. But as I mentioned in my likes for this week, I think what it does so well is that it provides the nostalgia of just being a kid, which people from any time period can relate to. When the world was, quote, simple, when the world was your friends, and your biggest stress was a school exam, or being late for dinner, or being sucked into a hellscape dimension with monsters that want to murder you. Like, everyone knows that feeling.
Yeah.
High school things.
Yeah. My favorite part of nostalgia is that when it came to the States, the reason that it became widely accepted and stopped being sent as a mental health problem was because companies realized that they could sell off their old shit they'd been sitting on for like 20 or 30 years. And corporate America got fully involved in it in the same way that it was like, oh, it turns out that if you give schizophrenic people like a tube and you tell them if you turn it upside down, you can sell it to God. And the United States was like, yeah, we need to like really hit this market hard. But there were still considerations that nostalgia was a mental health problem, but companies got involved and they're like, did you know that we could sell shit to these people?
But, like, it was like, we could make money off of it.
Yeah. Fucking insane.
And that's why you have it in literary devices. Like, that's why it became so powerful, is because we recognize that people want to be nostalgic and they want to have that feeling. And so what's better than that than just sell it to them?
Does anybody here have like a particular thing that really triggers their nostalgia?
For me, it's the opening theme for the first Halo video game, Halo Combat Evolved. Just the, like the monks singing that, and it just like, And anybody that played Halo fucking knows that sound. If you look at the menu for the original Halo game, that song is just in your head without even hearing the music. And for me, it's just like right back to middle school, right back to killing grunts left and right.
I was this weekend at TJ's wedding. I was recently back in my neck of the woods and drove up to my parents' old place. And the drive across, I've now gotten used to living in a semi-urban center where there isn't a lot of like space or pastures or anything like that. But driving along those like old roads, it feels like I fall back into a position as a kid staring out the window in the back of my parents' car, kind of moving through those old areas again. That was quite a nostalgia trip.
I think for me, the most frequent reminder that I have, and it's because I live with them, are my cats. I grew up with cats. We had a lot of cats. I think we had like 16 cats at one point, which is super fun. Sometimes when I am petting my current cats, I have those memories of being like a little girl, and I used to throw my cats birthday parties, and we would give them, me and my sister would give them pieces of bologna. We had like a little doll tea set, and we'd give them pieces of bologna on the plates and like water in the teacups. And, you know, we just lived in that time period. And we had doll strollers that we used to put them in and push them around, and little hats from the American Girl doll series that we would put on them as well, which they, you know, were thrilled about. There's so many memories tied with cats to me. And so I think having cats around my life on a day-to-day basis really does remind me of being a kid and remind me all the memories I have centered around cats.
So for me, it's a lot of the time it's place-based. So moving to Germany, I emigrated from Australia permanently when I was 23. And I lived in Germany before that, and I traveled over to Europe beforehand as well. And Germany was the country I loved the most at the time, but also, you know, a lot of kind of Eastern Europe too. And so when I go back there these days, that is just like, the nostalgia just blows me away. Like, the most recent time I went back to Germany, was 2017, with my then girlfriend, now wife. And we just went to a German beer hall that I, you know, the sort of places that I used to go to when I was 21, 22, loved all the time back then. And it was just, it was fantastic. It was, you know, it was a fantastic night. Luckily enough, my wife really liked that aspect of German culture as well. Even though it was a Bavarian beer hall in Berlin, which, as anybody who's been to Germany can tell you, is the least Berlin thing that exists. It was a great time. I've actually been to that beer hall before with Dave and TJ, who you met on the podcast earlier.
And that was a great night.
And our friend Christy. Now I have the time of my life. No, I never felt like this before. Do we feel bad at any point for the Demogorgon? In season one, not in season two, in season one.
No. Not really. It obviously this comes from the writing, and I feel like they give it a bit more intelligence than a straight up and down animal would typically have. So there seems to be a bit of malicious intent coming across for me anyway. So I'm almost like, yeah, you got what you fucking deserve. Quit fucking with these people. But like, it's an animal and it's got to eat. So
if that's the reason I don't feel bad for it, is because it kills a bunch of people. Like, there's a shitload of meat around, but it's still going after the kids.
Exactly.
Like, calm the fuck down, mate. You've got enough food to keep you going through the winter.
Yeah, I was definitely screaming at that thing to die the first time I watched it when Eleven is like crushing it. I felt no pity or remorse. My only thought kept going through my head of, make sure it's dead. Make sure it's dead.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
Kill Will.
Maybe it's like that species we came across in Outlander, where, you know, we theorized it's been deprived of its natural food source and it's eating humans because it can't get what it really needs, which, I don't know, maybe that's why it's so emaciated all the time. Would we recommend season one of Stranger Things?
Oh, yes.
For sure.
Yes.
For sure. Quality television. It's a fun journey. Good monster.
Yeah. I was three episodes in. I was just like, fuck, I can't believe there's 10 more of these things. Because for some reason, I thought this was a 13 episode season. But it's not. It's 8. It really clips along. There's not too much like waste of time in
just
there.
Just 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it was a really concise season.
Next week, we'll be considering our Stranger Things of Palooza with the back half or most of season 2 and season 3, talking more about the Demodog and the quote, Mind Flayer. from the later seasons.
Strangier Things.
Stranger Things 2, Son of Stranger Things.
Strangest Things.
Well, the Strangest Things will be coming on the new season, we assume. But yeah, remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
99 out of 100 times, kid goes missing. The kid is with a parent or a relative.
What about the other time?
What?
You said 99 out of 100. What about the other time? The one!